Climate change and New York. What did the Bloomberg administration do to get the city ready?
They also knew, because of all of this work that they had been doing, that climate change was going to hit the city and hard in the coming decades. And so they knew they didn't want to just rebuild after Sandy. They wanted to rebuild smarter. So what they decided to do was to create this massive rebuilding and climate resiliency plan.
That's journalist Catherine Bagley. We talk with her about the book she co-wrote, Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, Climate Change, and the Future of New York. Then we round out the show with a look back at some of our favorite interviews of 2013. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we produce this show, Mayor Bloomberg's term is ending and Bill de Blasio is succeeding him. The press is rife with lookbacks at Bloomberg's reign, but amidst a very mixed record, few mention probably the most important positive legacy he leaves, and that's his forward-looking climate resilience plan for New York City. It already has some successes under its belt, like much cleaner air than before he took office. Hurricane Sandy was a wake-up call for many of the city's residents. But the Bloomberg administration had already been planning a more sustainable city for 6 years before Sandy hit, and climate change resilience was a thread weaving the plan together. Because of Bloomberg, New York is a global leader in urban thinking about adapting to climate change. But the former mayor also pushed huge development projects on New York City's very vulnerable waterfront, projects that both add to carbon emissions and may be doomed because of sea level rise. Reporters Kathleen Bagley and Maria Gallucci, both with the Pulitzer Prize-winning news site Inside Climate News, have come out with a fascinating ebook about all of this. It's called Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, Climate Change and the Future of New York. I spoke with Kathleen Bagley in late November. Kathleen Bagley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
To the title of your piece here, of your book, Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, why do you think it is so hidden, this his legacy on climate change?
Well, I think, you know, he's had a very busy 12 years in office. He went in and it was in the wake of 9/11. In his second term, he was dealing with the recession. And then in his third term, he was dealing with Sandy. So, you know, he's been very busy, and then on top of that, he's also passed a lot of, I guess, controversial laws in New York, things like his soda ban and his stop and frisk police policy, and there's been a lot of education reform, and you know, those are generally the big, you know, crime and education and poverty levels and things like that. Those are generally what get the most attention in New York. And one of the reasons that we even decided to write this book in the first place was that we were talking to people that were hit by Sandy. And one of the things, we would say, oh, yeah, we're looking into, you know, what the Bloomberg administration has done on environmental issues and on climate change. And the most common response was, what do you mean, nothing? Really, most New Yorkers had no idea that the administration had spent 6 years really digging their heels in on this issue and doing a lot of work on mitigation. And the adaptation has definitely come more recently. But yeah, it was just people didn't know. And I think there's been some media coverage of individual projects here and there, but nobody's taken a look at kind of the entire process and the whole 6 years. So that's why we wrote the book and that's why we titled it the way we did.
After Sandy, Bloomberg, a Republican, endorsed Obama basically because he thought Obama had a better position on the climate. And he said, like the headline in Bloomberg's news, it's the climate, stupid. But as you just pointed out, it didn't start there. It started 6 years prior. How did Bloomberg's action on the climate start?
Sure. So it wasn't led by Bloomberg at first. I mean, This started in really 2005 when city demographers projected that New York would have 1 million extra people by 2030. And the city was already cramped at that point. And they, you know, public transportation during rush hours was incredibly crowded. Then the city didn't know what to do with things like off-duty garbage trucks, you know, where to park them. And so land was valuable, and it really started as a land use strategy, you know, looking at where do we fit 1 million extra people and all the extra infrastructure that's going to be needed to maintain the quality of life. And so they started kind of looking at land use in the city, and what they realized gradually, it was, you know, over a year, was that they could answer all those issues while also addressing sustainability and climate change. And so it evolved from a land use plan to a much broader kind of climate and sustainability plan. And this was at the same time that climate change was growing at a national level. It was around the time that Al Gore's and Inconvenient Truth came out. And so people were starting to pay attention to the issue. And Mayor Bloomberg comes from a scientific background. And so for him, you know, we had an interview with him in September, and he, you know, he never questioned the science behind climate change. And so he just said, okay, this is something that we need to address. And climate scientists and environmental groups had been warning the city for decades that they needed to do something about this. So it just kind of all blended together into this massive plan that came out at a perfect time. But it didn't start that way at all. It started with 1 million extra people.
The population issue. Mm-hmm. And so they started this Plan YC, that's PLA, and then in capitals, NYC. How did it work? What was it, and how did it work?
So it was this kind of massive strategy to transform the city, both physically and invisibly, because, you know, a lot of what they were doing were things that New Yorkers weren't going to see. So, you know, they wanted to create more green spaces. They wanted to plant more trees, and they wanted to better waste stormwater management systems, things like that. But then they also wanted to actually help fight climate change, and so they were doing things like replacing dirty fuel sources with cleaner fuel in buildings, for example, and things that were cutting the CO2 emissions. And the city set a goal to reduce the CO2 emissions by 30% by 2030. And on top of that, they were also cutting harmful pollutants, things like soot, and things that would have public health impacts as well. So it was kind of a total transformation. It dealt with everything from, you know, housing and parks to waterways, transportation, energy, waste management. It was kind of an entire restructuring of the way the city would function.
Now, New York is a notorious city for getting anything done. There are so many powerful competing interests. Plan YC, or this sustainability office, I guess, is what was created here, and an advisory board. How did it bring the different groups, developers, the different agencies, labor, how did it bring them together, and how did it end up that they were all kind of managed to get on the same page?
It was quite a feat. And so what they did is, as they were creating this report, is they really pulled all the disparate interests across the city together and got them involved in the planning process very early on. And one of the best examples of that is perhaps the Sustainability Advisory Board, which had business interests, environmental interests, developers, just kind of everybody from a bunch of different industries across New York that generally just fight over these issues. And it sat them down at a table starting in 2006, the year before the plan officially launched. And it was a secret committee. I mean, nobody really knew about it except for the people actually on the committee. So it, you know, what they were discussing wasn't being leaked to the press. And so they could have these really open conversations and really discuss, you know, the future of the city. And then the Plan YC organizers would take all of these ideas and incorporate it into the actual plan. And so it was an open forum for these people to talk about, you know, what they wanted to see, their concerns, and even just getting them all at one table was a remarkable feat. And there were several different task force things that looked at, you know, there was a climate change task force and things like that. And but one of the remarkable things was that, you know, everybody knew that the mayor was fully behind this plan. And I think that's why it was so successful and why these groups were all very invested in participating, is because they knew what they were saying had the support of the mayor, that he was going to throw his full weight behind the plan. And so that was a very powerful message.
And his team, the sustainability team, came up with 127 projects that they put into 10 different sustainability goals. I don't know that we have time to go over all 10, but what were some of the key goals on sustainability?
So, you know, a lot of them was just greening the actual city. So things like creating more parks, more green spaces, planting more trees. They also wanted to, New York has a lot of industrial land that is just sitting there vacant because it's contaminated. And so what, you know, a big initiative was to actually clean up what they call, these spaces are called brownfields. And so far they've cleaned up 8.3 million acres of brownfields. And they've also, you know, things like expanding, incorporating more hybrid taxis across the city and greening the transportation sector, things like having buses that run on kind of natural gas or other cleaner fuel alternatives, and cutting building energy consumption, things like that. And then also, like I said before, the greenhouse gas emissions reduction was a kind of an overarching thing that they wanted to do. And kind of everything that they were working on was to strive towards that goal.
Yeah, in fact, you say that, you know, climate change was just one of 10 goals, but at a certain point they realized that it was actually central to all 10.
It was. And, you know, that was, again, kind of a gradual realization for them. And they realized when they released the plan, and even after they released the plan, that everything that they were doing was going to help fight climate change. And so, you know, things like planting more trees is going to pull more CO2 into the air or out of the air. And so it really became kind of an all-encompassing, project for them. It kind of directed their thinking.
One of the central topics of discussion you talk about, Catherine Bagley, you talk about in Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, Climate Change and the Future of New York City, which you co-authored with Maria Gallucci. It was congestion pricing. This was a very big deal. It took them some time to get Bloomberg on board. First of all, explain what is congestion pricing and what did the plan propose that it would do?
Congestion pricing is actually, it's a system in which drivers would have to pay an additional toll to enter the really busiest parts of New York. And it's a system that has been used in London for years, and very successfully used. And New York actually got the idea from watching how successful the program was in London. And so they wanted to implement it in New York because it would not only help foster people, commuters using public transit, and it would help reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it would help improve air quality in the city. And I mean, Manhattan is very busy, it's very clogged with traffic, just from people coming in and out every day. And what they wanted to do, I think the toll was going to be $8 to enter New York during the kind of the peak hours, or Manhattan specifically. And it was going to also bring in billions of dollars for public transit investments. And so it was this plan. And the mayor had previously said that he wasn't really supportive of a plan like this. I mean, it's a very politically contentious issue because, like you said, New York is very complex and they have a lot of different kind of powerful lobbying groups. And so there was some concern that whether or not something like this could actually pass and the feasibility of it as well. But gradually, the mayor is very, very focused on data, which is very evident by what his private company is. And he was convinced by what his sustainability organizers had brought to him. And so he threw his full weight behind the plan. But again, it was a gradual process for him. And ultimately, it was the project that got the most attention when Plan YC was first released, and it ultimately failed in the state legislature.
I wonder if you think that there was kind of a messaging failure here, because you point out in the book, Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, that, you know, when polled, a vast majority of New Yorkers said that they would prefer cleaner air, and yet also a majority were against congestion pricing, which probably would have done more than anything else in a swifter fashion to clean up a good portion of New York's air. So do you think that there was a kind of messaging failure here?
I think that there was. I also think that there was a lot of confusion about exactly what the program would entail and the benefits of it. But I also think that this was very much a state legislature issue from the very beginning, and so I'm not sure how much public support of it would have even helped. It was such a politically contentious issue that even if the public fully understood the benefits, I'm not sure how much that would have helped in the end.
But it also failed big on the Senate Democrats. Do you feel that Bloomberg bears some of the responsibility for not having played the political game well enough to get the Democrats on his side?
I think that's a possibility. It's hard because I think that, you know, I think he thought he had a good amount of support going in. And there was a lot of kind of backdoor meetings that happened that I think he just wasn't prepared for. And so, yeah, I think that could have been an issue, but I don't know how successful it would have been no matter what he did.
Now, you mentioned before the switch to cleaner sources of fuel oil. Talk a little bit about how this happened and what were some of the impacts on building codes, on, working with the New York City building industry and real estate industry, which is probably, you know, the most powerful outside of Wall Street of all the vested interests.
Yeah, so, you know, what they knew that they wanted to deal with the issue of dirty heating oil fairly early on, but it really didn't. It was kind of an add-on Plan YC program. It really started with Andy Darrell from the Environmental Defense Fund, who's the New York Regional Director of the Environmental Defense Fund in 2009, and he kind of looked out his window and he realized just kind of the black smoke that was billowing out of these buildings, and what they wanted to do was, it's called number 6 and number 4 heating oil blends, and those are kind of the dirtiest heating oils that you can get. And, you know, it wasn't going to be that hard to switch, I mean, theoretically, but the building industry in New York is very powerful, and it would also take some money, and this was coming at a time where New York was still dealing with the recession a little bit, and it was going to take some money from these guys. And so what ended up happening is they passed this clean heat program, and it required these buildings, thousands of buildings across New York, to start changing their heating oils. And then on top of that, there was a program called the Greener Greater Buildings Plan, which would require building owners to increase the energy efficiency of their buildings, things like checking for leaky windows and doors, things that let heat escape, and improving those issues so that way they were using less energy to heat their homes and reducing emissions.
And there was also the Cool Roofs program, which was a very simple solution. Talk about that.
Yeah, so it was, you know, like anybody that goes out in the middle of summer, you know that wearing white clothes is it's reflecting off heat instead of if you're wearing black clothes and it's absorbing the heat. And so that was kind of the concept behind the Cool Roofs program. And a lot of roofs in New York were kind of this black tar type material, and they were just sucking in the heat. And in the summer, people were having just ramp up the use of their AC to cool down their apartments. And this is only a problem that's going to get worse as the decades go on, because the number of days in New York that are going to be above 90 degrees by 2050, you know, right now we have about 18 days every year that go above 90 degrees, but by 2050, that number could go up to about 57 because of global warming. And you know, they wanted to address this issue. And so it's as simple as painting the roof of your building a white or a gray, something that reflects the heat. And so, you know, something that doesn't take a lot of money and doesn't really take a lot of effort, and it has these kind of massive benefits.
And we're talking with Catherine Bagley about the book she co-authored with Maria Gallucci. It's Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, Climate Change and the Future of New York City. So now let's talk about Sandy. That was, of course, the huge wake-up call. And you write in the book about the report that came out after Sandy, you know, barely a year after Sandy, not even quite a year, a major report that came out about how New York City was going to adapt to climate change and global warming. Talk about that report.
Sure. So about a month after Sandy hit, and the Bloomberg administration was kind of just starting to, the immediate recovery efforts were starting to kind of calm down a little bit. And they started thinking about what the long-term recovery process was going to look like. They knew that, I mean, the damage that Sandy had done was going to take years, if not decades, to recover from. But they also knew, because of all of this work that they had been doing, that climate change was going to hit the city and hard in the coming decades. And so they knew they didn't want to just rebuild after Sandy. They wanted to rebuild smarter and more prepared for a future climate-related disaster, and not just another hurricane, but also things like warmer temperatures and heavier precipitation events and things like that. And so what they decided to do was to create this massive rebuilding and climate resiliency plan. And they officially got started in early December of 2012. It basically launched into a 7-month period of time in which a staff worked nonstop to look at how New York functioned and all the things that needed to be improved to protect the city from future climate-related threats. And the end result is this 438-page report that has over 250 initiatives in it that really span across the city's 5 boroughs and include things like a massive coastal protection system that will hopefully protect the city's 520 miles of coastline.
Now, just a couple of days ago, I took my bicycle out onto the Brooklyn Bridge Park, went along the bike path there, and I noticed all these kinds of berms, and I wondered to myself, how did this area, because it seems so low, this is the area of Cobble Hill, how did it fare during Sandy? And I was surprised and pleased to read in your book that it was one of the areas that was spared Sandy's wrath precisely because of these kinds of installations.
So the Brooklyn Bridge Park, which sits just under the Brooklyn Bridge on the East River, was a project that was part of the administration's kind of Plan YC efforts. And most people just see it as a beautiful green space, which it is. I mean, and it's stunning. I think it's 1.3 miles long. It has gorgeous skyline views of Manhattan, and the park is just beautiful. But I think what a lot of people don't know is that they purposefully designed that park to withstand a storm like Sandy. And so, you know, as you're walking around, there are hills in the park. The way that the park is contoured is to help kind of hold back a storm surge. And to also, the actual material that the park is made of is kind of a porous material that will allow stormwater to quickly kind of be drained back into the river. And so after Sandy, as they were recovering, they noticed these little kind of pockets of success stories. And so the report that they prepared is basically a massive expansion on projects like that. And so it's more parks that are developed like the Brooklyn Bridge Park.
And there are other plans for ideas for oyster reefs, for giant gates that can close off at certain, I think there are two points, giant gates that can close off the storm surge from coming up the Hudson River and up the East River. You know, oyster reefs, maybe not so expensive, but those gates cost billions of dollars. What do you think is going to actually happen? I mean, do you think that there is the commitment to continue with this? And, you know, Bloomberg is not going to be mayor after January anymore. We've got a new mayor, Bill de Blasio. Do you have any sense about where this is going and what is going to be the fate of this climate plan?
Yeah, and so that's actually a question that we spend the majority of kind of the last chapter of the book discussing is, you know, that the Bloomberg administration has worked for 6 years on these issues, but they're gone as of December 31st. And Bill de Blasio he's expressed his support for the Bloomberg administration's work, and he said that the climate resiliency plan that they released after Sandy was a good blueprint. But there's a lot of uncertainty. He hasn't given a whole lot of detail about what exactly he wants to do. And the other issue is that Bloomberg has, his legacy is not kind of in the best state right now. The New York public is pretty much divided over how they view him, their approval of him. And it's because he's passed a lot of controversial bills. And so during the mayoral election this past year, most of the candidates stayed pretty far away from him. None of them sought his endorsement. He stayed very far away from the races. And so a lot of people are worried that when Mayor-elect de Blasio enters office, he'll want to start fresh. And Bill de Blasio definitely ran on kind of a anti-Bloomberg. He campaigned himself as an anti-Bloomberg. And so there's a lot of questions about how many of the Bloomberg-era initiatives he'll actually continue. And people say that he could very well kind of use what the Bloomberg administration has done as a guideline, but kind of scrap all that work and create his own plan. But that could be a really costly amount of time to do that, and something that climate scientists warn we don't have time for. We need to act now, and creating a new plan could take years.
Well, I don't think Bill de Blasio ran so much anti-Bloomberg as he ran anti-plutocrat. And, you know, Bloomberg did a lot of controversial things, but I think the election was very much came down to a kind of, you know, disgust with the inequality, the vast, you know, the two cities, a tale of two cities. And Bloomberg does have a very mixed record. On the one hand, he's been very pro-development, which is development is not necessarily the most sustainable, not even the most sustainable development. There's been a huge amount of commercial development, which is very carbon intensive on the one hand, and yet he's been a climate champion on the other. Do you think that these two have actually been in conflict with each other, and that may be what muddies the record?
I think it's a possibility, and you know, I mean, one example of that is Mayor Bloomberg has said a lot, for example, that we cannot abandon the waterfront. We will not abandon the waterfront in New York, that it's one of the kind of the city's most valuable resources. But climate scientists warn that with sea level rise, we might have to abandon part of the waterfront. And Mayor Bloomberg has very much pushed for development of the waterfront, you know, not just with parks, but with, you know, actual buildings. And so I think it's a sticky point. And that's one of the things that we hope that we achieved in the book was talking about he's done a lot of really great things, but it's not perfect. Everything that he's done is not perfect, and that there are people that disagree with a lot of his decisions.
Well, the book is, we've only really touched the surface. It's not a long book, 67 pages. It's not an expensive read, $2.99 on a download, or people can also read it chapter by chapter at the Inside Climate website. It is Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy, Climate Change, and the Future of New York City. Catherine Bagley, thanks so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you for having me on. It was great.
You can find a link to the book Bloomberg's Hidden Legacy at writersvoice.net. Coming up, a look back at Writer's Voice in 2013. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, the new year has turned, but we are not so far from 2013 to look back at some of our favorite interviews from last year. As always, we were blessed with a surfeit of great authors and books, and it's always hard for me to choose between them for the year's 10 best. But some stand out, so in no particular order, here are excerpts from five of my favorite shows of 2013, and you can find links to five more at writersvoice.net. One of the many things Congress failed to do before it ended its 2013 session was pass comprehensive immigration reform. And while deportations are down from the previous year, they continue to be at the highest level compared to previous administrations, tearing families apart. Deportation due to draconian immigration laws passed by states is the subject of Rilla Askew's wonderful novel, Kind of Kin, set in Oklahoma, the first state to pass such an immigration bill. Here she is in an interview we aired in January. I found this book, I mean, not only is it a terrific novel, but it really made me understand on a gut level just how terrifying these laws are. In the novel, the bill has been passed, and as Kind of Kin opens up, we are with a 10-year-old Dustin who is staying with his aunt Sweet and her husband and his cousin who's a little bit older. Why is he there?
He's there because his grandfather, with whom he lives, his grandfather has been arrested under the provisions of the fictional state bill. The boy's grandfather, Bob Brown, has been arrested for harboring illegal aliens in his barn in a little rural town in southeastern Oklahoma. When the grandfather is arrested, there's no one to take care of Dustin, and so he has to go stay with his aunt.
You've described this as a novel about people who want to do right but still do wrong, and others who do right in spite of themselves. Could you give us an example of that in the story?
One of the main characters is Aunt Sweet, who's Dustin's aunt and Misty Dawn's aunt, and she's the one who tries her best to hold her family together. Bob Brown, the grandfather, is her father. He's in jail. She's charged with taking care of this little boy, with trying to arrange things for Misty Dawn, and who's left in dire straits because her husband has been deported. So Sweet tries the best she can to hold her family together, and she keeps making mistakes, not out of ill will, simply because she doesn't really know how to deal with all the pressures that have come to bear on her family because of this law and because of her father's action in the face of this law. So she's the one who wants to do right and still does wrong. There are other characters, and I would say probably Bob Brown is one of them, who does right in spite of himself, because the consequences of him taking this action, his family suffers. And yet the awakening in the community and people outside of his family to the consequences of the laws have a really good, strong effect.
How much of this book is actually based on reality? I mean, I understand that you have a situation in your own family which comes close to one of the situations in this book. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a niece who was married to an undocumented worker, and as a result of that law, her husband was deported. So, you know, we had a family situation where we, you know, came to experience the results of that law and also the complications of the broken immigration system. One of the things I wanted to do in the book is not write a polemic or not write a position that's only one way of looking at the circumstance. And yes, there has been, over the course of many years, an increasing population of people who don't have legal status and yet live here and, you know, marry here and have children here and work here. And it's grown over the course of decades so that many, many families are affected. And the families that are affected are not necessarily all Hispanic families. And, of course, immigration issues apply to all immigrant populations. And so the question is very, very large. But in this particular case, I was able to experience what happens when a family is shattered because one of the members is deported. And that's something that most, you know, middle-class white families don't necessarily experience firsthand. We may have opinions about it or even sentiments about it, but then when you experience it firsthand, it becomes very, very personal. But the characters and the circumstance are all imagined. So Sweet is fictional. Bob Brown is fictional. Even the state legislator, who is the sponsor of the bill, is nothing, not even by gender, nothing like the actual state representative who did originally sponsor the real House Bill 1804. So I've created a fictional world and fictional characters, but the places are all real. So the little town of Cedar is very much modeled on the town where I am now, where my parents live, a little small town in the mountains of southeastern Oklahoma. The small town of Wilburton, which is in this same area, it's factual. When Sweet wants to go talk to her father and has to go stand outside the jail, outside the yard, to be able to talk to him because they don't allow visitors inside the jail, that's all fact. That's how they do it in Latimer County, Oklahoma. So there are many circumstances that are real, and yet there are characters who are fictional, who are living out the consequences of real conditions.
Rilla Askew, her novel is Kind of Kin. Someone recently asked me what was the best book I read in 2013. I read so many wonderful books this past year, but the one that excited me the most, because it taught me so much, was Carla Kaplan's Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. I'd know nothing about those women who had braved social ostracism to support the great African-American cultural movement of the 1920s and 30s, and to fight for political rights for blacks. White women who crossed the social lines of color were called Miss Anne, collectively. In Miss Anne in Harlem, Kaplan tells the fascinating stories of some of those women, and in so doing, raises profound questions about gender and racial identity. She also shows that white women who crossed the color line were especially reviled, even more than men. In fact, Miss Anne was treated like she was crazy. Yeah, in fact, you say she was often dismissed as a sexual adventurer or a lunatic. I mean, that's a pretty extreme.
Yes. The white press in particular looked at any white woman who took anything other than the most passing interest in black culture and either insisted that it was all sexual or that she was crazy, and sometimes both. So one of the white women who was held up for years in the white press as a cautionary tale, as a warning to other white women, do not do this, was Etta Duryea, the white wife of black boxer Jack Johnson. Johnson, in his day, was almost as famous for taking white wives as he was for his athletic prowess, for which he was renowned. And Etta Duryea, one of his white wives, killed herself. And the white press, whenever it would catch wind of white women have a very serious interest in black culture, black people of any kind, political, cultural, social, of any sort, would sort of trump out, would bring out Etta Duryea as a kind of a warning. Many of the women I write about, again, who were very serious about their commitment to Black culture and politics, they put Black Harlem at the center of their lives, found that everything they did was sexualized by the white press. Can I give you an example?
Oh, yeah.
So Mary White Ovington, white founder of the NAACP, a factoid not everybody knows, was doing her work in the 1920s. At that point, she was, I believe, well into her 70s. She was, by design, a very matronly woman. She cultivated a kind of matronly image. And she had lived all her life as very much a single woman. She believed deeply that for her to be effective in a Black community, because of the complicated history of white women in Black culture, she had to avoid any undue attention. And she strove very, very mightily not to draw any attention to herself. So she was not someone who cultivated press attention. But the press sort of became fascinated by her interracial, social, political, cultural gatherings in the 1920s. She ran some of the most important, well, today we would call them literary salons, interracial literary salons. And the white press, so here is this woman with, you know, decades of amazing political credentials, very matronly, in her 70s, long political record behind her. And the white press ran stories about Mary White Ovington, insisting that she had these salons to procure Black male lovers for young white women. That was the extent to which the press insisted on sexualizing the interest that white women had in Black culture. When that interest was avowedly sexual, as it was in the case of two of the women I write about, Josephine Cogdell Schuyler and Nancy Cunard, the press went mad. When the press caught wind of Nancy Cunard's relationship with Black jazz musician Henry Crowder, Nancy Cunard received literally mountains of hate mail. One of the things that struck me about the women I write about in this book is the extent to which the questions they're wrestling with really do remain questions that are unanswered for us. We do not yet know what we think identity is. Can we alter it? Is there an ethics to it? Are we somehow obliged to the people with whom, you know, with the group to which we were born? Do we consider freedom to be escaping the identities that we were born into? Or do we consider freedom the right to inhabit those identities with respect and dignity and recognition from others? We remain, I think, to this day, all over the map in our answer to those questions, even as we've made certain advancements. As these women went into Black Harlem, they were living within a culture, within a larger racist culture. They were living in a culture that was interracial, that was integrated, where it seemed that there were all kinds of possibilities moving forward for interracial work and interracial collaboration, but in which those deep questions about identity were roiling all the debates and were completely unanswered. And at least I see many parallels between that moment and our own.
Carla Kaplan's book is Miss Anne in Harlem. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're hearing clips from some of my favorite interviews of 2013. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Marissa Silver is one of my favorite fiction writers, and last year she published a highly acclaimed novel based on the famous Depression-era photograph Migrant Mother by Dorothea Lange. The novel is Mary Coyne, the name Silver gives to her fictional migrant mother. Well, you talk much in this novel, Mary Coyne, about the power of images and how they represent the world to us and how we interpret them. And, you know, when I said just before that I felt I understood this woman so much more than I had when I first saw the photograph, I feel I understand her because of the character you created out of her. So I'm really not understanding her. I mean, I don't know that much about her. And as you said, there's not that much written about her. Why do I feel, I'm going to ask you, maybe it's an unfair question, but why do I feel, why does the reader feel that they really understand this person now after reading this book?
Well, first of all, you know, that's a wonderful compliment that, you know, because it represents kind of an engagement, which is what any writer loves to hear. I guess, you know, because I made the character of Mary Coyne through, you know, close attention to detail and a very particular experience of this invented person, I guess that I was able to bring her, quote-unquote, alive on the page. But I think that the very difference between your sense of understanding Mary Coyne and your recognition that you actually don't understand any more about the woman in the photograph than you probably knew to begin with is exactly what I wanted to write about, because what interests me is the way that both photographs and also history are interpreted and how there's sort of a limit to our ability to know the, you know, quote-unquote truth of anything, that we are, you know, our understanding is always going to be subject to our subjectivity and our own imaginations and our and what we bring to, you know, confronting anything, whether it's a stark fact of history or an imaginative retelling of something. It's immediately interpreted in the same way that when, you know, my character Vera Dare, who is the photographer in the book, stands in front of Mary Coyne to take a photograph, the fact of taking that photograph alters the reality. She chooses a composition. She chooses a distance at which to stand. She brings to it her own subjective impulses that make her photograph have a certain character, and so reality is instantly altered. And that's what interests me. I'm not interested so much in, you know, how near to the truth can we hew. I'm more interested in understanding the distance between the truth and the interpretation of the truth.
And yet in that interpretation of the truth, I mean, there are many different ways to interpret, and some are more authentic, it seems, than others. You base this character on a woman who lived in a very real time under very real circumstances, very difficult circumstances. I'd like you to talk a little bit about those circumstances that she found in her life, that is, your character that found in her life and must have been the migrant mother herself. And also, I guess just to put a point in here, that in some ways there's a greater truth that you can get to through this interpretation.
Yeah, well, what I did with the book was I used sort of the frameworks of both of the women's lives in as much as I could learn about them and then invented on top of them. So it was sort of like an inventive elaboration on some facts. And the real character, Florence Thompson, like my character Mary Coyne, was raised in eastern Oklahoma on a subsistence farm, and she lived in a part sod house. She was quite poor. She was either half or entirely Cherokee. That's somewhat subject of interpretation. But certainly she was a descendant of the Cherokee Indians who came to that part of the country on the Trail of Tears. So that was her legacy. And then she married a young man, and they moved to California before the Depression hit. They moved in the 20s. And at first they began to work in the lumber mills, the lumber yards, cutting down trees and milling the lumber. And then when the Depression hit and those jobs became scarce, they began to travel the roads as migrant farmers. And, you know, the conditions that they lived in, like so many of the people, certainly in California, if not the rest of the country, were desperate. I mean, you know, it got worse and worse as the times got worse and worse. So people were, you know, working for pennies for incredible backbreaking work. Children were sometimes educated in these, you know, camp schools and sometimes not. Kids worked in the fields. You know, there wasn't a lot of medical care, you know, and so there were, you know, quite desperate situations. I think little by little, as the crisis both deepened and the government got more involved, there were some, you know, there were funds released and camps were set up and conditions were somewhat improved. But, you know, it was rock bottom for a lot of those people. But what interested me, you know, more than the kind of desperation of the moment for my character was the survival of the moment. You know, I'm kind of more interested in how people survive. I'm interested in endurance. And what struck me so much about that photograph and also about the lives of people I read about during that time was just the incredible will to endure in hardships that we can't really even imagine, even in our current economic moment. So that was really powerful to me.
Marissa Silver's novel is Mary Coyne. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview. And now to another of my favorite interviews and books. dipping into speculative fiction, Ruth Ozeki's wonderful novel about a spirited but disaffected and much bullied teenager named Naoko, born in the U.S. from Japanese parents, but living in Japan after her dad lost his Silicon Valley job. The novel combines history, science fiction, the spiritual teachings of Zen Buddhism, Ruth Ozeki is a Zen priest, and some terrific storytelling to make for a very compelling read. The novel is A Tale for the Time Being. I asked Ruth Ozeki about the title.
The whole novel is kind of like an investigation of time and, you know, in particular, time as it plays out through writing and through, you know, through the process of writing and reading. Now is, you know, this girl, Naoko, is sitting in a maid cafe in Tokyo writing to some unknown reader who she knows is going to be reading her diary in the future sometime. So the whole book is kind of like an exploration of these kinds of themes. And I suppose you could also call it an homage to Proust as well. I mean, you know, this is, you know, this unpacking of time is what he does so beautifully in A la recherche du temps perdu, in his great masterwork. So, you know, in a way, it's a little bit of an homage to him, but it's also an homage to a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji, who wrote a series of really interesting articles, essays on the subject of time. One in particular that I was reading at the time of when I was writing this book, which is called, in Japanese, it's called Uji. And this is, this can be translated in many ways as well, but it is usually translated as time being or being time or for the time being. And of course, all of those different puns play out in the course of the novel as well.
And in fact, you begin the novel with a poem of that master, the Zen master, for the time being.
Yes, that's right. It's a kind of a loose translation of the beginning of that essay. For the time being, standing on the tallest mountain top. For the time being, moving on the deepest ocean floor. For the time being, a demon with three heads and eight arms. For the time being, a golden 16-foot body of a Buddha. For the time being, a monk's staff or a master's fly swatter. For the time being, a pillar or a lantern. For the time being, any Dick or Jane. For the time being, the entire earth and the boundless sky. So this was a sort of a this was a kind of a contemporary translation of a very old poem.
And one of the meanings being that we are time beings. And we're not just in the moment for the time being, but we are time beings.
Literally, we are time being. You know, we live in time in the same way that, you know, that fish live in water. We live in time. That is our medium. So in a way, you could think of it as we are time expressing itself. We are the expression of time in the world.
And your book also has a very elastic relationship to time. I mean, without giving anything away, which I really don't want to, it moves in a very slippery way through time.
Yes. I mean, you know, I think once again it goes back to this idea of, you know, the way that readers and writers, that we're really collaborating with each other in time. A reader, you know, a writer sits down to write and in so doing sort of calls forth a reader sometime in the future. And in the same way that a reader, when a reader opens a book, the reader is conjuring the writer in the past. I think it was the ancient Greeks used to believe that, you know, when you recite the poetry of, you know, a dead poet, you are literally borrowing the tongue of the dead poet and bringing the poet to life. Or actually, maybe I have that wrong. It's actually the poet borrowing your tongue in the present and coming to life, you know, by means of that recitation. So it's this very kind of elastic and also sort of almost a collaborative relationship through time.
Novelist Ruth Ozeki. A Tale for the Time Being received the Man Booker Prize in 2013. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. The fracking boom is being called our ticket to energy independence, a bridge to a renewable future, a job creation machine, and a savior to cash-strapped farmers and rural communities. In other words, a panacea to all that ails us. But is it a panacea? Or snake oil. We spoke with energy analyst and author Richard Heinberg to find out. His latest book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future.
Back in the 2005 to 2008 period, we were seeing record oil prices, and still are actually, and very high natural gas prices, and that was an incentive for them to apply this expensive technology to developing low-grade resources, because basically that's all we have left to produce in this country. We've already pretty much tapped out our conventional oil and gas. So now what's left is tar sands in Canada, deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico, and these tight reservoirs where the rocks have very low permeability and low porosity. So it requires special technology like horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing to get the oil and gas out. So that's what they've done. And it's profitable to produce the liquids, the oil and natural gas liquids. But what's happened with natural gas is regular natural gas is that the producers have actually driven down the price below the cost of production. So this is an economic problem for the companies themselves.
So that seems to be a sustainability problem in and of itself. I mean, is this problem just one that's going to go away but leave us with a huge amount of stranded assets and environmental destruction?
Well, yeah, the problem of low prices will go away. The industry's trying to fix that right now with natural gas exports. Prices of natural gas are much higher in Europe, Japan, in South Korea. So if the U.S. can export natural gas to these places, then that will actually drive the price of natural gas domestically up very significantly. We're talking about prices. Just a few years ago, the natural gas price in the U.S. was in the range of $12 a thousand cubic feet. And that's in the neighborhood of the prices that we're seeing in Japan, South Korea, and Europe right now. Fracking has resulted in a temporary glut in the market, which has driven the price down to $3 to $3.50. Again, that's below the actual cost of production. The industry would like to see that price double or triple or even quadruple. But here's the thing. They've sold fracking as a way of providing America with cheap natural gas for decades to come. They've talked the utilities industry into switching from coal to burning more natural gas, the chemicals industry, which had fled the U.S. because natural gas prices were rising. The chemicals industry has come back. But now, if the natural gas industry raises prices, if they succeed in exporting natural gas, then that will drive the chemicals industry back to where they were, offshore. And it will result in utilities across the U.S. burning more coal and less natural gas. So all of the benefits that were promised will go away.
Richard Heinberg. His book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interviews we excerpted from today's look back at some of our favorite episodes of 2013. Others among my favorites are our interviews with Bill McKibben, Louise Erdrich, Dan Fagan, and Rebecca Solnit. Again, you can find links to all of them at writersvoice.net. Have a very happy new year. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.